Welcome to Doing Sustainability, a podcast that features practical and actionable approaches to sustainability, brought to you by Baker. In every episode, we have enlightened conversations with corporate and business leaders on the vision, motivation, actions, and impacts of sustainability.
We discuss best practices, fresh perspectives, tips, and solutions to help a company demonstrate its ESG commitment and position themselves for long-term success. Hi, I'm your host, Rocket.
And I'm your host, Gary. Let's start the show. Today, we're speaking with Jeff Trotter. Jeff, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Great to have you. I'm very excited to speak with you today. I think we'll quickly sense that you exude the essence of the show here. So let me get into this. You know, I'm going to start by reading Jeff's purpose. Aspiring to become a social billionaire and positively influence a billion lives socially or environmentally. His mission, with a proven success career in both profit and nonprofit sectors, he aims to implement a stakeholder-centric, collaborative approach to creating regenerative and systematic change, both internally and externally to organizations. Jeff is currently working at Regenibus. He's been there for the past 4 years. His current title for the past year is Chief Executive Officer. He is the co-founder. Previous to the CEO, he was the Chief Growth Officer. At Regenibus, they believe that there's a need to create a disruptive and innovative community driven by exponential actions in alignment with the UN Sustainability Development Goals, and to deliver both increased brand value, at the same time, provide solutions to many of the world's biggest challenges. They aim to democratize the opportunity for regenerative growth for all, to lead, learn, connect, and innovate through breakthrough solutions around humanity's greatest challenges, and deliver impact alpha for all stakeholders. Another current role Jeff carries is the co-founder of Regenerative Business Live. Regenerative Business Live is a series of events hosted at the United Nations with a focus on driving the UN Sustainability Development Goals. And on top of that, he's the co-founder of ESGXL. ESGXL is a RegTech SaaS platform designed for companies in any industry to support their ESG measurement, monitoring, and reporting. Jeff's resume is extensive and very impressive, from nonprofit to for-profit. He's worked in Asia, Europe, and the Americas. Besides CEO, he's also be a CMO, a COO, a Chief Development Officer, and a Customer Experience Officer. Jeff, welcome to Doing Sustainability, what it sounds like you've been doing for many, many years. There's so many things to talk about here. Here's three things. I want you to peel the onion on regenerative growth for all. Then something about, let's discuss the importance of viewing ESG disclosures and reporting and less as cost-bearing exercise and profit-generating. Must have how this generates both business and brand value, something that we like to talk about. I want to hear about corporations to move beyond sustainability to becoming a regenerative business, and about the continuum of non-financial corporate disclosures and reporting, from ESG to sustainability, CSR, the various frameworks available, covering materiality, double materiality, triple materiality, how ultimately non-financial reporting is essentially integral to corporate financial reporting mega process.
So where do you want to begin?
Well, thank you so much for having me on this podcast. I'm thrilled. I've been looking forward to it for some time. And the four questions that you are, the four areas, I mean, at the end of the day, they're all linked to one another. So if we look at them as somewhat circular and iterative, we could start anywhere, but where should we start? Let's go with the first one, because I do think it's a framing statement: regenerative growth for all. We capitalize the all because we want to focus on not just all 8 billion persons, but species too. And we can tackle the 8 billion. And really, when we talk about the 8 billion, we're talking about 8 billion people. We're not really talking about 8 billion people. We're talking about 7.8 billion people, because the 0.2 are already taking care of themselves. Thank you very much. They don't really need too much help, although they probably do need some help around thinking about regenerative growth for themselves, because I think what they're probably experiencing, and I don't know too many of the 0.2, by the way, but the mega rich, I do think that they're probably really unhappy at the base of everything, because their model is destructive and it's a zero-sum game. And I think that's essentially what we want to focus on, that regenerative growth for all really means that we're shifting from the current system, the economic system, which is largely monocapitalistic, to a multi-capitalistic view. And if we think of capitals as not just being economic capital, but intellectual capital, social capital, human capital, and natural capital, then if we think of a multi-capital approach to business, and then which is a subset of society, which is a subset of planetary boundaries. And so if we think of it that way, rather than equal, but we think of them as subsets, then we start looking at the drivers for regenerative growth for all. One might say, well, is that the responsibility of governments? Yes, no. We think at Regenibus that the responsibility comes down to businesses, because generally businesses have a much larger footprint than the geographic boundaries of most, well, of any country in the world, which has a geographic boundary. You could also argue, of course, that some of those governments and nations extend beyond those boundaries, and they do that in a very sort of neocolonial way. But that's another story. So let's come back to regenerative growth for all, and let's define, from our perspective, what is a regenerative business. The challenge facing businesses right now is they think through sustainability. We recognize at Regenibus that sustainability and a sustainability paradigm that most companies have adopted over a period of time is unfortunately not going to be enough to get us to where we want to be. So we have to move beyond sustainability, not to dismantle it, but to build on it. And the notion of regeneration is to do that, exactly that, to look beyond sustainability, to renew, to revitalize, and to restore all of the systems that a company is operating in, and not only the economic system. So we need to have companies begin to think of the planetary boundaries and society more generally, and therefore become a regenerative business, which in essence will drive regenerative brands. And that's where we think that more and more consumers wish to be spending their money. They need to be understanding that the brands that they're having in them, on them, or around them are regenerative brands, that they're trusting brands, they're transparent in their operations, and then how those products and services that they're creating actually manifest into the broader community.
Part of the solution instead of the problem.
Well, that's a great quote, and it should be on a t-shirt. And let's come back to that, because that is precisely what one of our initial funders in the seed capital raise, and I'll talk about that later, that's exactly what he said. He knows he's been part of the problem. Now he wants to be part of the solution. And so that's a great, and that is a t-shirt ready to be printed. You should do that.
We should collaborate.
As we already are, yes.
Exactly.
So regenerative growth for all is also a shift, a nudge to say, look, the current economic system, and people say to me, oh, you know, the current system is broken. No, it's not. The current economic system works perfectly well for those who designed it. The problem is it only works for them, and it's not working for the other 99%. So we need to see a shift in economic system that becomes beyond just the economic system. It becomes, you know, something that looks at all of those other forms of capital and to make sure that they're all considered. And that's essentially what we're looking to do with businesses, is to move them and nudge them so that they move beyond sustainability. Does that help?
Yeah. It really, for me, it started with the business roundtable redefining the purpose of a company to be engaged with all stakeholders. And I just, you know, I don't know. I know that, you know, internally you have to think about some change externally, you have to think about some change. You say, I've read from things that I looked at, that emphasizing that it's beyond traditional notions of change management. Can you sort of elaborate on that?
Oftentimes, folks say what we need is a transformative shift. We need massive transformative shift. And so they kind of push back against the idea of incrementalism. I actually think that we need both and, which is a great term that a former boss of mine used to use a lot, and I've adopted that, and we should all adopt that to some degree, rather than it being that or that, it's both and. And so an aphorism that we sometimes use is incrementally driving transformative change. And what do I mean by that? Well, the Beatles, the Fab Four, not the things that crawl on the floor. The Fab Four were not an overnight success. They, for 3 years, went over to Hamburg, and they incrementally drove their shift to become arguably the best band ever. And so there were these little increments that they did. And I think that's something that we can sort of bring back into sort of business parlance. I do think that we need to be, when we're thinking of typical change management, and I was formerly a consultant, worked for one of the big four firms, so I know quite a bit about change management processes. What we're really looking at here is this, is where do all of these incremental change pieces, how are they all stacked up together in terms of this big mega process of transformative shift, not only at the micro level within a business or in the meso level within the sector that those businesses are operating, but also at a macro level. So it's all sectors, all businesses. And remember also that when we talk about businesses and commerce, it's really just a subset of a broader community, humanity, which is a broader, you know, part of a subset of the planetary boundaries and the planetary limits that we have. We have limits to growth, as Donella Meadows has written about many, many times over decades with all of her team. So it's great that organizations are thinking and embedding change, but we also need to consider, as I said, making sure that all of this change is aligned to a much bigger shift, a transformative shift. And therefore, we then begin to introduce another term like just transition. As we transition, we must make sure that we transition in a just and respectable, in the sense that we must ensure we don't leave anybody behind. As we move to a decarbonized world, and we must move to a decarbonized world, then we have to then think, where is the opportunity for others to ensure that we do not leave them behind, so that there is regenerative growth for them also. But this transition, as we decouple from growth objective, you know, increased GDP, also means, you know, we need to also have in line increased energy usage. We need to decouple that. And that decoupling will mean that we'll need to shift some of the processes around jobs and job creation, et cetera, maybe even absorb universal basic income. But generally what I'm saying here is that the change management pieces, we need to look at the bigger picture, but we must make sure that as we transition, we do it in a just manner. And I think that puts a lot of pressure on governments and certainly a lot of pressure on companies, but it'd be very difficult. And we acknowledge, as courageous pragmatists, that it's very difficult for companies to just say, yeah, sure, we get it. We'll stop using petroleum-based plastics. We'll move to hemp-derived plastics or other, you know, bioplastics. It will not be possible, frankly speaking, for one company to adopt that change, because its competitors will just double down on the opportunity to maximize profits, and that company will then be left behind. So we have to pragmatically think about that.
And then there are companies that want to be left behind because they make more and more money doing that than investing in a business that's really sustainable over time.
Right, absolutely. And I think that's a great point you make. And we speak to that also in terms of the pathway to this transformative shift, building on from ignorance to awareness. And then we have a path. Classic ignorance, I didn't know, or I don't know about that. Well, as you move from ignorance to awareness, at that point, we all have a choice. We can either go down the path of, I'm aware, but now I'm ambivalent. I don't really care or not. Then it goes beyond ambivalence, malevolence, where it's like, I don't really care. Frankly, I'm going to double down. I'm going to continue taking stuff out of the ground, even though I know it's not doing us any favors, which ultimately is this concept of malignity. And we've sensed that there are people that, as you said, they don't want to change.
It's also the way they're incentivized. Our friend Allison Taylor, and she took a Gartner report, and it was CEO versus CFO priorities, comparing 2022 to 2023 priorities.
Mm-hmm.
And the top priority for both was growth. And that was for a CEO this year, or 2023, it was 45%. The CFO was 62%, but I think he responds more to shareholders, not that mm-hmm. the CEO doesn't. And that's a lot about what he's being judged on and compensated on. And down at the bottom, the smallest one was, we talk about CEO priorities, CFO priorities, the customer was, actually went up from 3% in 2022 to 6%, but still very small. Sustainability jumped from 10% to 12% in terms of a priority for a CEO. So Allison was blown away that the customer was just so low.
Total. Yep.
And it doesn't kind of make sense. We're talking about growth. Well, there's a lot of ways to achieve growth that's not organic, always through customers. But I thought customers would be a little higher on this research. But we're still incentivized to grow, grow, grow. And we kind of know that that growth isn't always based on regenerative models.
Absolutely. And it's great that you reference Allison. I saw that post. I'm a huge fan. Where have you been? What are you doing with your life?
I mean, she can call both on everybody and anybody, and she does it so well.
She's lived in the U.S. for some period of time, and she's quite the, she's very deft at that. I applaud her British roots. You'll never know whether you've been insulted by a Brit, because they do it in such a way that you kind of feel good about it until you begin to think about it. What really happened there? So I saw that post. And I noticed that her comment actually was a laugh. This is hilarious. It is hilarious, but sad, tragic. All
that's tragic.
And so, yeah, this continued focus on growth, short-termism, it has got us into trouble, and it will double down on trouble unless we really think long and hard. I saw another post on LinkedIn recently, and I had a conversation with the chap afterwards, a guy called Frank Dixon, wonderful, wonderful chap, doing a lot of very interesting work around system change. And he posits that we have three options: business as usual, involuntary change, or voluntary change.
Mm-hmm.
Business as usual isn't a choice. Involuntary change basically means if we do continue doing what we do, Mother Nature will just decide for us. And you guys have already witnessed this last
week
in Southern California, and that we cannot deny this anymore, that no matter what continued stupidity humanity exerts on the planet at some point, Mother Nature, if you look at it conceptually in that concept paradigm, will just make up her own mind. And to some degree, she's already doing that. So there are warning signs there. So if we don't, then there will be this involuntary collapse, meaning there will be this significant change. And many of us will get left behind, if indeed not even survive.
I also think that, I mean, when you talk about this short-term, long-term, it really has a lot to do with the greed of thinking that they short-term can just keep doing business as usual, whereas that long-term change that has to come, you know, really has to have that moral mm-hmm. and the right thing to do be a part of it. But you know, it's longer change, and we have so many companies that have, you know, maybe a CEO for 5 years. So how do you reach that leadership? And, you know, it somewhat is a really personal thing of that person. It's telling you a lot about that person themselves. And I often wonder, how do you work with leadership to address and get them excited about moving into being more of a regenerative business? Because for me, it's also so interesting because that's where innovation is. That's where the future is. And by holding on to the present and mm-hmm. even the past, the innovation gets less and less and less.
There's so much in there. It's like a big swimming pool. Not sure. But we'll go in the deep end. You know, I think I'm going to take a step back and finish that other pathway because it's relevant to where I want to go with this now.
Okay.
From ignorance to awareness, rather than ambivalence, we can now go to advocacy. I'm now aware of something, and I advocate for that. I think we, as an individual, as part of a family, a community, etc., I'm going to be an advocate for something. Beyond that, we're going to get off our backsides and go do something. So now we're going to be act. And I think that beyond that activation, we're then getting into stewardship, which is the opposite of being there's this malignant and the malignity aspect. And I think the stewardship is where we're now seeing purpose-led leaders go, and we would reference that as regenerative leadership, that they're beginning to think of not only their own purpose at a singular personal level, but how does that then translate into an organization? And so an organization, corporation, business moves in that direction. But again, I recognize, and again, in a very pragmatic way, it's all well and good that we might have these brilliant leaders, unless it involves other leaders from the same and beyond. That's the biggest challenge. So we need to be looking at how do we drive that systemic change. But this thing about growth, which was top of the pop charts in that post that you referenced, it's again this short-term aspect of fundamentally believing that the stock market is the economy. And when the stock market, as it currently is here in the United States, is riding high, everything is good, everything is rosy. And it's not. I mean, the more we begin to understand that the stock market is frankly the gambling playground of the rich, because they sometimes lose, and more often than not, you can never beat the house, so to speak, right? Some people will over a shorter period of time. But it all comes back to this stuff, this nonsense, frankly, on Squawk Box and blah, blah, blah. We need to think beyond this notion of growth as being the answer to it all. There's a groundswell and an increasing, almost moving towards a tipping point of a different approach, one called degrowth. I'm not a fan of the name, because as soon as you put D in front of something, it generally means negative. But degrowth is an increasingly talked about and becoming increasingly popular concept to look at policy shift that looks at putting ecological limits central to economic policymaking, and therefore not looking only at GDP as a measure of growth, a singular. It's all well and good that we might still look at economic growth, but we have to ensure that we do that within planetary boundaries and that more healthy society. And as I said, to make sure that 7.8 billion people do not get left behind and we have regenerative growth for all. But this short-term view with all these talking heads on Squawk Box saying, oh, you know, this is the stock to watch, et cetera, et cetera. And nobody ever sort of goes back like a week later and says, remember when that guy said this? And well, nobody does that because they've already moved on. So we need to think a little bit more around the sort of the growth aspect and get to a point where growth is not top of the charts anymore.
You use a term, and I want you just to kind of explain it a little bit. Impact Alpha for All. Capital A-L.
Yeah, that's exactly where I was going to go. Let's go back to the chaps, and it's generally white males sitting on Squawk Box talking about the market. Let's look at this group who are singularly talking about finding alpha, the advantage in the marketplace, that little stock shift that puts them ahead of everybody else. Nothing wrong with seeking alpha, but we think we should be seeking impact alpha. What do I mean by that? We need to think, let's go back to the five capitals. If we look at those five capitals, economic capital, yes, sure. We're not advocating the end of capitalism. We're advocating for the future of multi-capitalism. So let's look at economic capital, social capital, human capital, intellectual capital, and natural capital. We need to be making sure that businesses are delivering alpha across each of those areas of capital. And that's what we kind of refer to as building that within the organization, as well as then external to the organization. So now we're talking about not a single shareholder view or a view that looks at shareholders only. Shareholders are part of the broader stakeholder group, but we need to be looking at the multi-stakeholder group, of which, again, shareholders. But a real measure of the success of a business is really ought to be from a regenerative perspective. And it's looking at then how it is not only delivering an economic return, but is also delivering a social impact return, as well as an environmental impact return, positive in both instances. That we refer to as impact alpha. And let me just take a little step further. Let's look in the venture capital space. I know we're going down a rabbit hole here, but I'll make it a short rabbit hole, a not so deep rabbit hole. And venture capital. I would argue that we need to stop thinking of venture capital, but more those venture capitalists, certainly down the Sand Hill Road, not too far from where I'm sitting right now, become venture multi-capitalists. That they, within their portfolio companies, they should be encouraging those portfolio companies to be delivering impact alpha, because they will be the regenerative businesses of the future. It's very difficult to course correct the Amazons, the Targets of this world. But I do think that if we bake this notion of delivering impact alpha into the DNA of companies that are beginning to date through venture multi-capitalists, and that's a kind of a blend of impact investors and venture capitalists that are beginning to get it. That God knows there are enough venture capitalists who don't get it, that they're singularly focused on the economic return and hopefully 10 times and that they find the next unicorn. We think that actually impact alpha, we should be looking for zebras.
I love that.
That's how we're defining impact alpha. It's the broader concept.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, what I'm fascinated by is the interconnectedness. And when you say baking it into the, you know, startup, that's how it's going to happen. Because what we're seeing in, from our business, really, we're both involved in corporate brand creating and rebranding and, you know, all sorts of things like that. But we also do employer brand. Right. And, you know, right now, there's just a tremendous, people are starting to move, the people, the customer, and start at the customer and the employee and communities where you do business are starting to say, I want to buy from, I want to work for, I want to invest in, I want to, you know, only have businesses that are conducting their business this way. And that, I think, is, you know, the only, maybe the only reason that ESG is even that tiny concern of the CEOs. So I have a lot of hope, but there's so many companies, like you say, changing Amazon or changing Target, you know, it's so big and everything is so siloed that we're talking about from the top all the way down being interconnected, where everyone is a part of the other one rather than, you know, I don't know anything about that. That's not my role. That's not my job. But that mindset is really, you know, the sustainability of the business, the resilience of the business. Yep. And so got to go there.
It's not that I wanted to pick on Amazon or Target. I could have picked them too.
No.
There's a gazillion companies out there that look at the Russell 1000, you just choose any one of them. Ultimately, what I suspect will happen is they will begin to see profits being hit significantly because their supply chains will be being hit significantly because of climate disruption, et cetera. And if they're not already thinking of this, then they have their heads where their heads shouldn't be. I'd like to bring in a sort of segue to our approach to ESG and what ESG is as far as we're concerned. When we talk about ESG, environmental social governance, we look at it primarily from a risk mitigation perspective, a set of outside general issues and how an organization internally delivers and deals with those general issues. And at Regenibus, we're big fans of SASB, the Sustainable Accounting Standards Board. We license their data. We've adopted, and now we're adapting their data, baking it into a platform, ESGXL, which you point out that I co-found. Actually, ESGXL is a product as part of Regenibus, as is Regenerative Business Live, which is a media piece that we do at the UN. But ESGXL is a platform that will enable companies to measure, monitor, and report out on their ESG performance. And their ESG performance, so we call this ESG as a process, is to identify what are the materiality, the financial materiality aspects of their business. And those are the things they need to measure, monitor, and report out on. Why? Because it gives a very solid and sound indication to institutional investors that this organization is on top of its risks, it understands those risks and what it is doing to deliver to those risks over a period of time. And therefore, over time, through the the ESG report, which is not a sustainability report. We make it very clear to folks that we talk to. An ESG report is not a sustainability report. We're looking at ESG primarily as reporting out against a series of identified risks, environmental, social, governance, and there might be 8 to 10 typically across the 79 sectors that SASB have already done this work on. So we're taking a set of already known and agreed to standards, accepted standards, putting them into a platform that folks can then capture this data on an ongoing basis and with embedded infographics and Microsoft Power BI, et cetera, and also creating a template for what we believe an ESG report should look like, because there is no standardized ESG report. But so someone says, oh, have you seen our ESG report? And it's 500 pages and it's nothing to do with ESG. It's to do with sustainability or even worse, corporate social responsibility, which is an integral part ultimately of the construct. From ESG becomes the platform that enables an organization to then look at its products and service and therefore the inside out aspect of those products and services. And then we look at corporate social responsibility, which looks at philanthropy and some of the things that a company is doing. Sometimes the philanthropic aspect of what a company is doing is not even material. In other words, if they stopped doing it, it wouldn't have an impact on the business. It would not maybe a short-term blip, but it's not going to have a longer-term impact. We look at ESG as a process, and we help companies first and foremost identify their materiality assessment. If they're not a listed entity, because if they're listed, then generally have a 6 code, and it means that they've already been allocated to certain sectors. So therefore, these are the general issues that you should be on material. But our sweet spot, frankly, is to work with venture capital companies and talk to them about their portfolio companies and say, let us work with those portfolio companies, have those portfolio companies build out their prowess around ESG to demonstrate over time, whether you go to Series A, B, C, ultimately pre-IPO to then IPO. All along, you can then see that institutional investors will be, because it's their fiduciary duty, will be seeing and identifying that this company has its eye on these risks and therefore is delivering enhanced value. And therefore, from an institutional investor perspective, we're going to place a bigger premium on the price when it goes to IPO. Why would any venture capital company not want to do that? Generally, it's because they're asleep at the wheel, but that's what
we want to do. Thank you for explaining that. That was very good. So I'm going to ask you a question here, and it's a kind of a closing thought. It's 5 years from today, Jeff, and we're doing this podcast. What are we talking about?
We're talking about the successful transition of those privately held businesses that are demonstrating that there is an alternative, and they can very clearly show that there is an alternative. Went back 5 years ago, back to 2024, and we could see that we were in the midst of a polycrisis, that there was clearly a tipping point, and that tipping point led to organizations thinking more about what we call beyond growth, beyond that single paradigm of an economic measure, and that there was a tipping point. And I think we're now at the point of a tipping point. I think we might see a little bit more. I think we might look back and go, yeah, remember 2025, how even more chaotic 2024 than it was in 2024. But I think that by the time we get to 2029 and approaching then very close to the end of the era of the Sustainable Development Goals, which will end in 2030, I think that we would have already seen that in 2027, 28, we'd have seen some formation of what will follow from the Sustainable Development Goals, maybe the Regenerative Development Goals. I don't know. Steal that with pride. So I think that's, we will have seen a tipping point. We will not be out of the woods, but we'll be on a path that recognizes that the only choice we have is a voluntary shift, is to take responsibility for this as leaders and be stewards of a different paradigm.
I love it.
That's wonderful. Well, one thing that I always think of, you know, is that the tipping point for me always comes at, you can't evaluate a company now only on its financials. We used to do annual reports. We were one of the largest annual report producers in the West Coast for years and years and years. But, you know, when the internet came around, that business sort of changed because mm-hmm. the report became more of a compliance
document.
Yeah, so that it wasn't
notice and access.
It wasn't the narrative, the communication platform for the entire coming year of telling a company's story. But now, and I'm sort of surprised that more people haven't moved towards an integrated report of the non-financials with the financials, because that's the truth at this point.
Yeah. Well, I think the Europeans collectively are shaping that, and they're taking the lead. This is often the case. We can see in it, it comes back to one of the earlier questions you had around materiality, double materiality, triple materiality, and even dynamic materiality. But at the end of the day, when we are looking at ESG as a process and therefore within a business and an ESG report, actually the next step is that this ESG report, which is financial, because it's based on financial materiality. So therefore it really ought to be an integral part to a company's annual financial statement and statements. And in the same way that we have standardized what a P&L should look like, a balance sheet and a cash flow statement, we should also standardize what an ESG report looks like and how it is then integrated into those broader financial. And in 2029, when we look back to 2024, that will be part of what happened. I think that there will be a seismic shift that IFRS, and I was once a partner with Ernst & Young, you know, so I remember all too well. I also recognize that being within that community, it took an awful long time to find standardization about financial reporting. We do not have 100 and something years to get to a point where we are integrating ESG performance into the broader financial statements of a business. Yeah. And I think that is it's critical that we do that. It's not a nice to have. And I don't really care too much about how the red states here in the United States say, oh, we need to, you know, ESG is bad. And tell you that the initial investor into our seed capital raise, $1 million, they've invested $150,000 banked. The chap that said he'd been part of the problem, now he wants to be part of the solution, is a Florida-based family office and is a Republican family. You cannot make this stuff up, because he recognizes that this is not a fad. This is sound business sense. It just maybe doesn't want to go out there and say that. And I've now just outed him on a podcast. But that's you know, at the end of the day, it is sound business sense. If you're looking at long-term shareholder and stakeholder value, which is exactly what institutional investors are looking at. So no matter what your man on Squawk Box says, you just got to move beyond.
Fantastic. Jeff, thank you so much. Greatly appreciate it.
We'll stay in touch.
I kind of feel like I want to call you next week and kind of...
Well, anytime. I know that in the past that you've also asked folks about books and all, but if you don't mind, can I just give a quick shout out to one book? It's when I look at books, I'm an avid reader of fiction, because I actually think fiction stands the test of time. When you look at business books, they're very much like of the now, and a year later, it's like, well, we've already moved beyond.
Yeah, that flavor sort of.
Yeah. But that said, and we referenced Alison Taylor earlier, Alison's book, Higher Ground, is coming out next week, I think.
Yeah, I've ordered it. Yeah.
You have?
I'm jealous where I see other people posting their copy. I mean, where's mine?
Yeah, where's mine? You and me both, Gary. My understanding is that this will go the distance, because it really gives an indication of I think, the next 5 years. But I've always, you know, when I look at fiction, I do find that some works of fiction are like The Alchemist, Paulo Coelho. I mean, I go back to that book on a frequent basis. But there's another book, there's a chap called Justin Dillon, who is the founder and CEO of Made in a Free World. He's looking at supply chains and modern slavery in supply chains. And he's uncovered a tremendous amount of stuff. And he has a book called A Selfish Plan to Change the World. A great read, because it's full of his own anecdotes as a failed musician and how his own purpose was defined. And it truly is a great book, because it's also, there's a lot of historic aspects in here of how we got to where we are in a situation, say, in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Give us that title again.
A Selfish Plan to Change the World, with the subtitle, Finding Big Purpose in Big Problems. Justin Dillon.
Great. Thank you so much for sharing that.
My pleasure.
Well, stay in touch.
Yes. It's just not enough time in a day. All the very best. Thank you both.
You're doing your work. We need more of it.
Well, thank you so much. Okay. It's a pleasure.
Thanks for listening. This is just a reminder to follow Doing Sustainability wherever you get your podcast. And please leave a rating and review if you like the show. It helps others discover us. And of course, we want more listeners.
If you want to learn more about our agency, Baker, and how we can help you build your corporate brand, align your culture, and evolve your ESG reporting, head to bakerbrand.com. See you in the next episode of Doing Sustainability, where we focus on practical and actionable approaches to sustainability to create long-term value.